Good afternoon and welcome to the rules hearing of the South Dakota Supreme Court. Let the record show that the notice of this hearing has been given through the normal channels. For those of you that have not been here before, this is a fairly informal proceeding where the court takes input on the proposed rules. If you're here to speak on a specific proposal and that's been completed, feel free to leave. I know some of you have other time commitments. And we'll just proceed through the rules in the order in which they were published in the notice. I'd ask that the proponents probably not comment unless there are specific objections to the proposals. I would say that the court has reviewed all of the proposed rules plus the comments that we've received in writing. So with that, we'll proceed to rule number one, which is a entitled adoption of a proposed new chapter to be rules for interactive audiovisual device use in court proceedings. Does anybody wish to, received written comments from the Honorable Charles B. Corman, United States District Judge, Presiding Judge Jack Von Walt of the 5th Judicial Circuit, UJS, and the Honorable A.P. Fuller, Circuit Court Judge of the 7th Circuit, and Judge Jeanine Curran of the 7th Circuit. Does anybody else wish to comment on proposed rule number one? Judge Poitras, podium.
Thank you. I'll be brief. As you indicated, Judge Von Wald had sent in a letter along with our proposed rule setting out the rationale for our proposed rules. And I would just like to emphasize that the Fifth Circuit was the pilot project as far as video conferencing is concerned. One of the reasons for that, or maybe the main reason for that, is the fact that we're a fairly rural circuit. We have four circuit judges covering 10 counties, and scheduling is a concern, as well as the travel. There have been many instances where the lawyers and clients are asking a circuit judge to set the matter by video conferencing because they can get in front of the judge sooner that way than they would have to, or what should it be if they would have to wait to have a personal appearance. The proposed rule as it is now would be more restrictive than what we're using the technology for currently. It would be more restrictive than what a lot of our judges in the circuit are doing, even by phone. And so the rule was drafted with the fact in mind, or the thought in mind, that when the parties want to use the technology for this reason, let's use the technology to its greatest advantage. If there is an objection and a personal appearance is requested in the type of proceeding set forth in Rule 9, then at that time, the personal appearance would be granted. But if all parties are in agreement, let's use the technology to its greatest benefit.
So there's no expansion on the use of ITV from the current proposal unless all parties agree. Fair comment?
That's a fair comment.
Any other questions for Judge Poitras from the bench?
So you use it for felony hearings, and what kind of felony?
Felony arraignments, felony sentencings.
You do use it for sentencing. Pleas? Do you use it for pleas?
Correct.
Okay.
When the parties ask for it, many times they can't get on the felony schedule. For instance, in Roberts County, it might be 45 days, but the people just, the defendants, if they're going to be sentenced on a felony and go down to the penitentiary, they just want to get it done with and, you know, get down there and start serving their sentence. And so if they request to do so, they're allowed to, and there's been no objections because it hasn't been forced upon anybody. It's only been made available.
So you're saying you're basically offering a service and no more?
Correct.
How long was your trial practice?
4 years.
No, but I mean, how long was the how long was the trial period for this procedure?
I guess I don't know the answer to that. We've been using it for the past 3 to 4 years, and I don't know how long it's been considered a trial and how long it's been considered permanent. Well, I would say we'd have 3 to 4 years experience.
Any further questions from the bench for Judge Poitras? No, thank you for coming, Judge.
Thank you.
Any other comments on proposed rule number one? Okay, if not, we will close comments on proposed rule number one and go to proposed rule number two, which is a proposal to amend SDCL 50 and 656C, which is dealing with motions for summary judgment. Are there any opponents to this proposal? Any proponents for this proposal? Okay, there being no comments, we'll move to proposed rule change number three, which would amend 1526A4 on how appeals of right are taken. Any opponents to this proposal? Any proponents for this proposal? If not, proposal number four would repeal SDCL 1526A6.1, apparently in toto. Any opponents to this proposal?
I would suggest that that there's a question in my mind as to whether or not there's any necessity for having having the attorney and his or her client sign the notice of appeal. I'd like to hear what the purpose of that was, and to that extent would oppose it. I would encourage the use of the word or, so that it could be, in other words, where there's a pro se person, that it can be signed by that person or his or her attorney. So I would insert the word or instead of and until my thoughts are otherwise.
Do you wish to comment on this proposal?
Yes, Your Honor. Ann Holzhauser, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Department of Social Services. I apologize. I didn't catch when you covered the amendment to 1526A4, which goes along with the concerns that were just expressed. It would be our understanding, or when reviewing the proposed change, we assume that the change was made in part because of the difficulty that has arisen in certain cases where a notice of appeal is filed in an appeal from an ANN proceeding, particularly a termination of parental rights. And after the notice of appeal is filed, the appellant's counsel cannot locate the parent. Again, that was our assumption that the revisions are directed to that, and we support that change to the extent it's directed to that problem. We did express in our submission to the court concern, though, regarding protecting the confidentiality of the parties, and had suggested revisions to the proposed amendments which would address the confidentiality concerns. I would also add, and this is something I apologize that I did not include in our submission, and that is a question regarding the effect that the proposed change would have on parties other than the parents, guardians, or custodians. By that I mean if the appellant is the state, is a tribe, or is a minor child.
Thank you. Any other comments on either one of these proposals, if they're interrelated? Now we'll close comments on that. Number five is a proposal to amend 1526A60, dealing with appellate procedure. Are there any opponents to this proposal?
That's been withdrawn. That's by Zella, isn't it?
No, that's a judicial conference.
Oh. Okay.
I hope this is still on the table. This has not been withdrawn, has it, Madam Clerk?
No.
Okay. Any opponents to number 5? Any proponents? Move on to 6. Adoption of a new rule to be designated as 16.3.5.1, dealing with a proposal for the South Dakota Supreme Court to promulgate rules establishing standards for home studies. Are there any opponents to this proposal? Ms. Holzer?
Yes, again, Ann Holzhauser. I'm not sure if I characterize myself as being a cautious supporter or a friendly opponent to this rule. The department does not oppose the rule to the extent that it would establish standards. However, as we have addressed in our submission to the court, as the rule is written, it would apply to all custody proceedings, which could be interpreted to include custody determinations under the juvenile code. The department conducts, through its employees or through a contract with Children's Home Society, conducts many, many home studies for kinship care, foster care, and adoptive placement, as well as renewals and updates on a yearly or three-year basis to those licenses. To the extent that the standards that would be promulgated or adopted could change the requirements or the ability of the department through its employees or through its contract with Children's Home Society to complete those home studies, we would oppose the rule as it's written.
Okay. Any further comments? Mr. Dugard.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to just echo what Ann Holzhauser brought out. I had put forth a very simple amendment, but I think her proposed amendment is actually better. And so to the extent I can me too her testimony, I would like to do that. And we don't oppose the notion of setting standards for those who do child custody hearings where parents are in dispute over who will have custody of their child. We don't want those standards to extend to more home studies than I think the proponents intend. And that is, we want to continue to conduct the home studies for prospective foster parents, prospective adoptive parents, and relatives of children who are in the foster care or juvenile system. I would venture that those performing those home studies are either employees of agencies, such as Children's Home, where there is an extensive amount of supervision and quality control in place, versus the custody studies that are often done in divorce proceedings are often done by individuals who may be doing this as a side venture to their regular employment, or they may be just individuals conducting that as a part-time job, and there may be no supervision whatsoever of those. So again, to the extent that the rule could be drafted in such a way as to limit it to those child custody cases where you've got a dispute between a husband and wife over who gets the children. If you could so limit them, then we are not in opposition. And again, I think the amendment offered by Ann Holzhauer is well done. I mean, we'd support that amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Holzhauser, to clarify, did you submit that in writing, or was it just a suggestion you had?
You asked if we submitted the amendment in writing. Yes,
I think that'd be helpful.
Pardon?
Did you do it?
I already did.
Okay.
It's included in the last paragraph of our submission.
Okay.
Addresses the home study rule.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Any other comments?
Yeah, there's some proponents.
Yeah, I know. But of opponents to the current proposal. If not, we'll hear from the proponents.
Thank you. My name is Krista Herring-Graber. I'm the executive director of the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. And I believe it was our organization that wrote the letter requesting the standards. And I'm just going to just briefly explain that, because I know there's others here to testify also. But the reason, the main reason, I have worked with victims, survivors of domestic violence for 20-plus years now. And we also, our organization also works with a civil legal assistance for victims grants. So we work with attorneys who provide services when there is divorce and child custody and domestic violence. And I have heard over at least the last 5 or 6 years from many survivors that have expressed concerns that they did not feel that their homes, they were treated fairly in the home study process. Because they did not feel that the home study evaluator understood the issues of domestic violence, sometimes even failed to look into the police reports and the any criminal background or any background that would substantiate the domestic violence. And sometimes because, as was explained to me before, one example, when a woman leaves and goes to the shelter and is in crisis, and maybe the alleged abuser, the male who's staying in the home, the alleged abuser, looks very in control, has the job, has the finances, and the woman is in crisis and is staying in a shelter and doesn't have a home and doesn't have a job, and it puts maybe a very difficult situation to determine what to happen with the kids. But the women that I've talked to have felt unfairly treated in those situations.
So who are those people, the people that you're directed at here, the alleged problem, are these, who generally, who are these people that you're concerned about, and how would this solve that? I mean, the people that you're concerned about might still qualify to be certified. I don't know that that'll address your issue.
I understand that. We're asking for standards and guidelines, as other states have. I actually have a handout here from the Counseling Board of Examiners, and they list different sites where other states have issued standards and guidelines for home study evaluators.
Who normally administers that?
The home study?
No, the standards and guidelines. In other states, who actually administers it?
The letter addresses the child custody guidelines and standards, standards of practice for child custody evaluations. APA has many, has guidelines for divorce proceedings, specialty guidelines.
Is it the courts, though, that are promulgating these rules, or is it another agency?
I do not know the answer to that. The only other thing that I would add today is that if guidelines and standards are set, which we're hoping that there would be some consistent guidelines and standards for home study evaluations, that the evaluators be required to have annual training on domestic violence so the evaluator can recognize the characteristics and dynamics in the domestic violence situation and make sure to keep that in consideration, because as you well know, that if it's overlooked, it could jeopardize safety.
Well, I think this is a two-step process. What we have before us today is a rule that would grant the court authority to promulgate rules, but if it's a promulgated rule, we'll be back for a second hearing to take public input in on what specifically those rules should include. Do you care to comment on the position of the DSS and the Children's Home Society on limiting this to basically disputes between parents?
Yes, I would agree with that, and I failed to bring that up in advance. I do agree that we wanted this to only be focused for child custody and divorce proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could we have your handout, please?
I do. I have two handouts here for you, okay. And then I know that there was others that wanted to. Do I get these over?
Other proponents of this proposal?
Good afternoon. My name is Sean Jalsma. I recently had to endure a home study. I was one of the fortunate ones. The individual who did my home study didn't just have a BA. This person had other qualifications. This person was extremely thorough. when we got to court, I have no idea. It did not seem as if the judge bothered to even look at the home study. And I don't understand why. I didn't ask for the home study. I had to pay for half of the home study. I had to, you know, speak to this individual on more than one occasion, and so did my child. And then it was almost a wash. I was in a situation where I went through the time, trouble, and money to get other professionals and individuals who actually knew my children for 12 months up to 9 years to testify at my custody hearing, and then a home study was asked for. So I have to pay for that on top of it. My ex's lawyer offered up three different individuals, and having gone through this and gone through this over 2 years and having four different attorneys, one name kept popping up. Other names were dumped and kept being dumped. And when I asked why, it was because, well, this person is an attorney and does it on the side, or this person is a retired so-and-so and they only do it periodically. And I got to thinking, who is qualified to do this? And so I picked a person who my fourth attorney said, this person does well, they're very thorough, and they're fair on either side. But how did I know? And then it was hardly even looked at. So then I had to go to even more expense to have the home study individual come to court and testify, almost having to, you know, justify what that person had written in the home study. They'd already gone to all of that time and effort, and I'd already had to pay for half of it, which I didn't ask for. And then I have to pay more money out to have them testify. If there was some sort of rubrics or something that says if you're going to do home studies, you have to have this much knowledge and this much education and this much background, and then these things have to be addressed, it would make all of us feel better. In my circumstance, it ended up in the best interest of my child. But when we were in court, the feeling was that dad has rights. Well, what about my child's rights? My kid had to go through a home study, not only at my house, but at dad's house. And then we're all worried about the grown-ups' rights? The children need to have rights, and that home study person is the one person who can be there to look at what is in the best interest of the child. And I don't think it was properly addressed, and I don't know why it wasn't by that certain judge. But I was fortunate enough to have a home study person who looked at what was in the best interest of both of my children. But they need to have standards, because it took 3 months just to decide on a home study person because I didn't know who they were or what they were. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have just a question. Are you in a populated area or a less populated area of the state?
I come from, I'm from Canton, so I'm from 20 miles away from here. Yeah. And the home study person came from Sioux Falls.
Yeah. Thank you. Any further proponents for this proposal?
My name is Cami Shuldes. I'm from Pierre. My case has seen court twice. I had home studies done both times. There was about a 6-month time span in between the two hearings. In that time, the home study reports changed from awarding custody to me to awarding custody to the father. Neither study was conducted in the same manner, and neither study cites what changed in the conditions of the homes to warrant the change of opinion. The first home study done in 2001 was done by Dr. Simpson and said I should remain the custodial parent. Dr. Simpson stated father wasn't ready to take care of child, and his home wasn't ready either. 6 months later, the father took me to court again, and there were two home studies done, one by Jans and one by Simpson. Dr. Simpson said father should get custody with no reasoning as to why or if his home conditions had improved. There was no consistency on how these studies were conducted. Even the two that Simpson did were radically different in how he conducted the home study. One example is that Dr. Simpson did not require the same testing and information from both parties. When asked in court by my lawyer if he made Herb do all the tests and paperwork as I did, Dr. Simpson replied, no. Dr. Simpson told me that everything he was making me do, he was also making Herb do. My lawyer asked Dr. Simpson why he failed to mention the chemical dependency test he had Herb do, or even give the results in either report. And Dr. Simpson responded, I don't have to put everything in my report. Dr. Jans obtained the testing done on Herb. He summarized the testing and stated that Herb still has an alcohol problem. They failed to investigate the environment my son would be exposed to on a daily, nightly basis. They both made recommendations such as having a cell phone, yet neither investigated the area to realize that Beulah, Wyoming has virtually no cell phone reception, so I would have no contact with my son. Dr. Simpson appeared to be friendly to me in the first home study and ruled in my favor. In the second one, he came to my home and appeared very angry and aggressively towards me. The second one was in the father's favor. The only thing Dr. Simpson wrote down while in my home and peer with me and Albert was my wages, my supervisor's name and number, and the address of where I worked. Dr. Simpson did ask to speak to me alone, which was confusing because I thought he was supposed to watch Albert and I interact. That's when I asked Albert to go to his room, and Dr. Simpson berated me about moving. Don Jan's method was radically different from Simpson's in every way. He based his on IQ testing and said whichever parent scores more closely to child's IQ should get custody. Instead of making a good comment in his report, he would state her home doesn't appear to be in a gang-related area. This is the kind of negative condescending commentary seen throughout his report. The attorney general for the state lives two blocks away from me. I guess he doesn't live in a gang-related area either. Simpson wanted to change custody. Jans did not unless alcohol problems were addressed. Jans' testing indicated that my son had a more emotionally close bond to me. According to my lawyer, the court shouldn't break a close emotional bond the child has it with the parent. Otherwise, it will be detrimental to child and parent. I know it's been detrimental to me and Albert. Both testers looked at income in my job, but never stated what Herb did for a job. Jan stated in court he didn't know what Herb did for a job. Neither study addressed how the environment would affect Albert. There was no investigation into schooling, family, friends, religion, babysitters, or even negative factors in the law like domestic violence, alcoholism, police reports, visitation issues, and exchange sites. Neither study realized or addressed how Herb's job keeps him out of the house 7 nights a week. There are, however, comments like Jans's reports where he states that I alleged domestic violence but can't prove it. At the same time, Jans refers to comments of the father's without any offering of its proof or the standard of proof. Proof of my allegations was never requested nor investigated. And two reports from the same time and facts. If the two reports from the same time and facts are conducted in such radically different manners, how is a judge to compare and apply them to the law? In this case, even their final conclusions were different. Simpson wanted custody change. Jans thought it could be done if the father worked on his alcohol problem. Otherwise, it should not be done. Jans isn't really answering the court's question. We aren't there to look at whether we can do something, but what is best now. Furthermore, neither home study tells the court what has changed in the home environment to warrant a change of custody. Again, there is a conclusion without helping the court answer the legal question. Finally, there is no supervision of these studies. Simpson changed his opinion completely based upon my move to Pier. I moved from Spearfish to Pier, 200 miles away. He never cites or speaks of denying visits, impact on my son, malice in the move, etc. Why did his opinion of someone who was not ready to care for children suddenly become the one to endorse? What justified changing the only custodial environment my son ever knew? My lawyers have asked me these questions about the studies, and I cannot answer them. He never addressed it. There is nothing to show or check for the objectivity of the report, the basis of the opinion, or the standards of law used. Judges endorse these opinions, yet may not be given answers to any of these questions. There is...
He didn't do that. Go ahead.
There isn't even a place to file a complaint on how a study is conducted. If we are to use counselors and their evaluations to help courts make decisions on the best interests of the child where there's no ongoing treatment, then we must have standards of reviews for these evaluations. Otherwise, courts have no way to determine if the study relates to the standards of law or just how they are conducted. There needs to be consistency, or all we are doing is throwing dice to determine where the child goes. Children deserve better. I know lawyers have, if you have a complaint on a lawyer, you go to the state bar. If you have a complaint on the judge, you go to Judicial Qualifications Committee. But if the judges and the lawyers aren't making the major life decision of where that child goes, it's up to the home. They rely, give the home study of evaluator 80% of the weight in court or whatever it is, but they're not being held to a standard either. I mean, I don't understand why lawyers and judges and teachers, everybody has a standard and requirements and a board to complain to if they fail to put something in their report, but home study evaluators who are making major life decisions for a child, they have no standards or requirements or a board that reviews their reports. I don't understand. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any further proponents for proposal number 6?
Hi, I'm Rahali Requist, and I've been a survivor for 2 years, almost 2 years. And the main reason why I'm here today is I had a home evaluation study, and for the safety of our child, we have to do our visitation exchanges at the police station because that's the safe place for us to be. And all I'm asking for today is that there be some kind of licensing as far as education-wise to domestic violence, so that way a person like me doesn't have to go to the police station to feel safe. You know, why can't he just come to my home and do it regularly? So I just ask that home evaluation study people have standards that they can see signs of domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you. Other proponents to proposal number 6?
You know, I have a question. I don't know if anybody can answer it that's here, but do we have any kind of an idea of how many home study evaluators there are out there, or home study people, or where they come from and what their backgrounds? Does anybody know anything about that?
You know, I can speak to it a little bit tonight. Well, here's if someone's going to speak to it.
Thank you. I can take a... I'll try to answer the question because I did do a fair amount of research. I do believe that a lot of the home study evaluators in the state do have a master's degree in counseling, in social work, and some are psychologists. There are a few that do not are not licensed, so would not have any oversight of any licensing board currently in the state.
Are those the ones that this is meant to address?
Primarily, I would say yes, but I would also ask, and I know that might be a later hearing, that domestic violence be something that is required in the standards, that there be annual domestic violence training, because even though they have a license, a counseling license or a social work license or a psychologist, does not mean that they have experience and background in working with domestic violence. And so we are asking that to ensure that if there is domestic violence, that they are able to recognize the dynamics and characteristics. I don't know if that answered your question, but
Do you know how many we have out there? Do you have a guess on that?
And only that I can guess. I am aware of maybe a dozen at the most in the Sioux Falls area. That's what I'm aware of. I would say there's less in the Rapid City area, and then, of course, in the rural areas, very few. I think that some of the home study evaluators in the rural areas probably come from the larger areas and travel to the smaller rural areas to do the home studies.
It's interesting that we have not had any response from any of those people.
We may have one once we formulate a rule. They may come in then to. My wife was a former custody evaluator. I say former because she doesn't do it anymore. But in Rapid City, there's maybe four or five people who do it now, and it's to do it right requires a tremendous amount of work and effort and knowledge and experience. Mm-hmm. And many evaluators simply have people come to their office and they take a test, mm-hmm. or they draw a picture. They have the kids draw a picture. And when I was circuit judge, I found it very frustrating that someone would come in and say, well, they did good on their Minnesota multiphasic test, and the child drew a house picture, house person type thing, and so I'm recommending custody to so-and-so. The good ones go out and go to the home. They observe the children, interact with the parents. They may do testing, too. They may individually interview people. So I guess I have a sense that we ought to have some standards for these folks, but I wonder how many people we would be eliminating. I don't know. How many people would be willing to meet those standards, because it's such a difficult chore.
If I would guess that those that are providing very good home studies right now, from my limited experience, are already meeting those standards. But if we add the domestic violence component also, that's just increasing. Of course, any of those that are already doing a great job will just make it better and provide more and more safety to the families.
It just makes sense to have the domestic violence component there, to be able to recognize the signs of that kind of thing, and to put that in the report is just absolutely has to be there.
I would agree. I think it's crucial. And the other part is that if it's overlooked, somebody could end up dead. So
yes,
it's very important.
It almost would appear to me that besides setting standards for the person, that there almost needs to be standards for the study itself and what it needs to include, which is not part of this, obviously. I mean, you could still certify somebody or set standards for the person who's doing the home study, but that still doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a decent home study that has all the information that the judge needs to make a decision. So
I would agree.
Well, don't you think we should have both? If we make a rule, we should have standards for the person and standards for how the home study should be conducted. That's something for another day.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any further comments on proposal number 6?
Yep, there's.
Okay, we have a lady in the audience, I guess.
My name is Renee Turback, and I've been conducting custody evaluations for the past 25 years. And I appreciate what these folks are attempting to do. I do think that there needs to be some standards. I don't know if licensure is the answer, but I do believe that there does need to be some standards. In Sioux Falls, there's probably about 5 of us that conduct custody evaluations. I know a lot of us travel, all the way out to Chamberlain, all the way up to Aberdeen and down into Yankton. But I do think that standards, a procedure, the APA style, and requiring people to have some sort of domestic abuse training or background. So, but there's really a limited amount of people that do custody evaluations in the state of South Dakota, as far as I'm aware. And I, after 25 years, I'm familiar with probably the majority of them. So, okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
You know, I think we've already got some kind of a rule about mediators need to be on a list. It's a list that's approved by the court. And you and I have been, you were involved in that when we first had to set up that list and
that's correct.
So forth. And I don't know now, I guess I've been away from it for a while. I'm not sure how that's working. But it sounds good on paper, but when you go to implement it, it's very difficult for the courts sometimes to know who should be...
Who's qualified.
Yes, who's qualified. And we face that with the mediator thing.
Right.
And I'm concerned about this being the same thing, is that if we say, yes, we need to do this, then we need to put resources in. It's going to cost money.
That's correct.
And you're going to have staff, and you're going to need to be able to, in the final analysis, enforce it and take it away from people that aren't, and we don't have, very often times the court just does not have those kinds of resources.
Exactly.
To run a program of licensing or certifying or whatever that we really need to do. And I'm concerned if we get into it, it's got to be done right, and my concern is we don't have the resources or the knowledge inside the court system to do that kind of certification, just like we ran into with the mediators. And I think we kind of call upon your group or the mediators or people that do that to help us with it. Well, is that, I don't know how well that works.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that probably the majority of the people who are conducting custody evaluations, I mean, the reality is the attorneys should be aware of who's out in the profession and who's good and who's going to be thorough. So, some needs to lay on the attorney, too. So, thank you.
Thank you for coming. Any further proponents on proposal number 6? Okay, we'll move on to number 7, which is a proposal to amend the SDCL 1616 regulations of Board of Bar Examiners. Any opponents of this proposal? Any proponents? Yeah, I guess I do.
I thought you were going to get out of this, didn't you?
Now, my understanding is that if this rule is passed, Indian law would be a mandatory question on the bar exam.
Correct.
Now, will the same other subjects that are currently being tested on still be tested on? Or is this an addition to those, or how are you going to deal with that?
This is an addition to. It's one additional question. What happened, and I think it created some confusion, the way we proposed the new rule, we actually showed a deletion of the current topics on the essay exam. That was actually a side issue. The National Conference of Bar Examiners has slightly changed the issues that will be on the multi-state essay exam. They have actually added to what's fair game. They've added 3 or 4 additional topics that may be covered on the multi-state essay. Instead of us running back to this court every year as a Board of Bar Examiner to ask for a rule change showing the change in topics, we have revised our rule to simply say, please refer to the National Conference of Bar Examiner website for a list of complete topics that will be covered on the multi-state essay exam. So what happened was it shows a deletion, but actually it's an addition, not just of Indian law, but of some other additional topics. There will be no deletions. This is simply an addition.
So you aren't going to delete civil procedure?
No, we're not. Okay. We're not.
Okay.
How does this fit in with the national standards when, I presume, this question isn't going to be asked or on the list in every state? How does that work?
We, as a Board of Bar Examiner group, will be drafting our own question. We will be drafting a sample answer for that question and then grading it just as we grade the rest of the essay questions. What we do as a board is when we're finished with our grading process, we spoon feed our scores back to the national conference, and it's just a mathematical equation as to how that score, the ultimate pass or fail score, is achieved. So to the national conference, it doesn't matter whether the substance was an Indian law question or the substance was a civil procedure question. session. They just want to know the number from us. They're not so concerned about the topics. As far as bar review or preparation goes, New Mexico was the first state to add the Indian law topic to its bar exam, and Washington will soon follow, I believe, as early as this summer. We would be the third in the nation. Bar Brie, one of the bar review courses, has Indian law material available. But in addition, we have spoken to Frank Pommersheim, Professor Pommersheim down at the law school, as well as Professor Patrice Kanesh down at the law school. And they would be willing to do a side mini study course for the graduates of our law school or anyone who's interested as an additional preparatory process before the bar exam. So, in addition to the national conference's supportive, they just want to know our number, but there are actually bar review course materials out there and other ways to prepare our students and students from other schools to prepare for this exam, even absent them taking an additional course in federal Indian law.
And they'll continue to take your number, even though the testing subject might be something that they haven't approved?
Correct.
Okay. Is there an option to not take the Indian law course, the exam question? In other words, if you get eight questions, can you always choose one that you do not want to write on?
The students sitting for the exam are never given an option. The people that are given the option are actually the board. Every year, before both the February and the July exams, the board is given a pre-list of the questions, and the board members review those questions. We're typically given nine essay exam questions from which to choose. We pare that down to six, and then we accept six of the questions. So the board is actually given an option, but the students are not. The students have to sit there and write on whatever questions we decided to throw their way.
So if the Indian law question is on the test for the next 6 years, they will be compelled to have taken either the mini preparation or the law school course.
Or hope for the best.
That's not very helpful, though.
So there is a possibility that when you select it every 3 years or 4 years or whatever, it would turn. You may not have an Indian law question on it. It just goes into the mix like everything else?
It does not. The way the rule changes read, we will now take the nine questions that are offered from the National Conference. We will pare those now down to five. In addition to those five essay questions that we get to select as a board, we will add one Indian law question of our own. So whereas some of the other topics rotate, the way our rule suggestion is written, there would not be an option of the Indian law. It would be a guaranteed question every year.
Was that a unanimous vote of the bar examiners?
It was.
Why?
Why? It's an interesting question. It means an awful lot of additional work for us as a board. Jim Leach and myself have an interest in Indian law, and the rest of the board was quite supportive. Indian law stands in a unique position with regard to the rest of the law. The Indian population in our state is an important one, but there is no other subset of our population that has a separate set of rules for jurisdiction. If a crime is committed against an Indian person, who has jurisdiction over that? It is very difficult to practice in this state for any amount of time without bumping into an Indian law question, whether it may be a simple traffic offense on or off Indian land, or a crime against or by an Indian person, a wrongful death case involving an Indian person against the tribe or against someone from off of the reservation or off of Indian land. The jurisdictional questions are very difficult, and regardless of whether you choose to practice in the field of Indian law, the board does not feel that you can maintain a practice of law in the state of South Dakota without sooner or later bumping into a question of Indian law.
And but the Indian population is like 7%, if I understand it. And this places this on the test at probably a 20% equivalent of the total. So it's way out of proportion to at least the population, maybe not the meaning or the importance.
Actually, the way it ends up proportionally, it will be one of six essay questions, which is taken in turn and added to one of two multi-state performance questions, which is then merged into a score for one of 200 multiple state bar exam questions. So in the broad scheme of things, it is about one,
Well, it's one of six essay questions, but it is one, it would be far less than 1% of your total score on the bar exam. So it would not be technically out of whack with the population in general by the time it's added into the rest of the bar exam.
And I didn't follow your math, but I'll do it on my own, I guess.
Any further questions for Ms. Sabers? Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other opponents or proponents on proposal number six, or seven, excuse me? Okay, the next proposal would be proposal number eight, which would increase the number of judges.
Just a minute.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I thought I had the court's attention back there. Dean Nacer, I had written an opposition to this bill, this proposed rule, and I want to withdraw part of what I said, and that would be that I said civil procedure should not be replaced by Indian law. And I think that that's still very important. I've been assured by Jim Leach that that is not going to happen under this proposal, and that civil procedure will still, of course, maintain a prominent place in the testing of the law students. My concern is I have practiced law for 33 years here, and I have not run into an Indian law question. And I've done an awful lot of areas of the law, a lot of trial work, a lot of administrative work, a lot of all kinds of things. I ran into one service of process question, and in the last 2 years, and I called Kit McCarran out in Pierre and said, would you serve these papers for me on the reservation? I don't believe that it would be appropriate to compare the necessity of Indian law to the population exactly. I don't know that that's a proper comparison. I do believe that it is going to maintain in most law offices a very small, if not insignificant, portion of a practice, if not non-existent. And so I don't oppose adding Indian law. This is South Dakota. We do have a very much a pride in our Indian population. I do think that we have to take a good look at the overall picture. I certainly would leave it up to you as to whether there is a need to add Indian law to the bar exam. It doesn't seem to make sense to me to make it the only mandatory question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nacer. And we did get your submissions, too. Any further? Sure, if you'd like to.
I think Dean just, in a sense, proved my point. I think, and the point of the Board of Bar Examiners, I think one of the most important aspects of Indian law is to know enough of it to know when you're practicing it, even if it's by accident. Dean said that he's never bumped into the issue, yet his example was calling his friend Kit and having Kit handle the service of process for him. Dean knew enough that he had treaded into the field of Indian law to know that he needed the assistance. And I think if for no other reason, to know when you're treading into a field where you're not sure of yourself and you need assistance of someone who knows more about the field, I think it's a good thing to add to the bar exam. But in the long run, we have a large population here. We have a large population of Indians here. But again, regardless of the numerical factor of that population, there is no other subset of our population that has its own set of rules for on and off Indian land, for by or with Indian people. This is the only population subset that has its own set of rules, and for that reason, we think as a Board of Bar Examiners that this would raise the awareness statewide and would help lawyers and judges become better educated and better aware of these issues when they happen upon them.
I might just say, too, that 2 years ago, this court appointed the Equal Justice Commission to look into potential inequities in our system as against minorities. And one of the key recommendations that this commission, that our commission gave, was that an Indian law question be added to the bar exam, because in all the places we went to around South Dakota, and we went to many places on the reservation and off the reservation, we heard complaint after complaint about lawyers not understanding Indian law and not understanding Indian culture, and yet they were placed in positions where they were having a great effect upon Indian people's lives. And so the Equal Justice Commission unanimously made that recommendation. I understand that it's already been discussed with the dean of the law school, and there is, as I understand, until today, I have heard absolutely no opposition to this. I think it would be a tragedy for us to not have this on the bar exam in some fashion so that the lawyers in this state understand, as you so eloquently put, that that they need to understand something about Indian law, at least to the extent of knowing that they don't know enough and need to refer it out. So I thank you.
When this issue was first brought to our attention, Judge Pat Lee was also a member of our board, and I know that he served with you, Justice Konenkamp, on that Equal Justice Commission, and Pat was also very supportive. But once again, it was a unanimous opinion of the board that this was a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments on proposal number 7? I'll look in the audience this time. Number 8, which would increase the number of judges for the Second Judicial Circuit from 8 to 9. Presiding Judge Severson.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the court. I am Glenn Severson. I'm the presiding judge for the Second Judicial Circuit, and I'm asking the court to favorably look on the proposal to increase the number of judges in the Second Circuit from 8 to 9. The legislature was good enough to fund an additional judge for the state. Representative Cutler is present, and she was very instrumental in this. Lieutenant Governor Dugard was here and left, but I do want to publicly thank the members of the legislature for listening to us and the court's support when it was presented before the legislature.
Okay.
Any questions at all? Would be. Thank you very much.
Just one question. If we approve this, do you have any date for when you think it would be operational?
Well, that will be up to the Judicial Qualifications Commission. I have talked to the State Bar about advertising the position if it is approved, and we would move forward with it as quickly as we could.
So we're looking 4 to 6 months, maybe.
I'm thinking probably in 6 months.
Okay.
If this is approved, he's not going to displace me and kick me out of my office, is he?
There isn't a chance of that.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Judge Severson? Thank you, Judge. Number 9. It would be an adoption of a new rule designated as 18.1.11.1, dealing with court reporter's authority to administer oaths and depositions. Any opponents to this proposal? Any proponents? One from the audience.
Dean Nacer again, Your Honors. I proposed this rule, this modification to 18-1-11 of our code, because it says in that statute it is a Class 2 misdemeanor for any notary public to affix his official signature to documents when the parties have not appeared before him. And the word appearance has been, in recent years, construed to mean a personal appearance face-to-face. We were doing depositions in my office in the usual way with two attorneys who had agreed to have a telephone deposition of a client, the defendant, rather than drag that person halfway across the country. Minor objects of the deposition, we felt comfortable doing it. So the two lawyers are sitting there with the court reporter. We put the person on the speakerphone, and the court reporter has to tell us for the first time that in last year's bar convention meeting for the court reporters, that there was a position taken that this statute prevents them from giving the oath over the phone. And so I am simply proposing a rule that would continue the normal frequent practice by when it's by agreement. The court reporter can give that oath over the phone. The lawyers would, of course, have to know who they're deposing. We always, if there are exhibits involved, give the exhibits to the person, just like a normal telephone deposition. So the telephone depositions are not uncommon, as you know, but the question is who administers the oath. Technically, under our rule, it would have to be a court reporter we don't know in the foreign jurisdiction under that circumstance. And so we prefer to use our court reporters that we know and trust and have them present with us taking down the information. The other part is if you've got a speakerphone, it's nice to know that the court reporter and you are hearing exactly the same thing, and I think it adds to the reliability of the effort.
Any questions from Mr. Mason?
Now you say it has to be, I thought I heard you say it has to be by agreement of both sides. But I don't see the language in there that talks about it. But I guess what I'm wondering is, suppose one of the lawyers objects. It looks to me from reading your rule that the court reporter could overrule that objection and still certify.
Then you're in front of the court on a protective motion if you're not going to do it by agreement. This I didn't mean to infer the rule provided that it's only okay. By agreement, but the common practice is that we agree to take a telephone deposition. I think you know you judges don't ever really see those things in civil procedure motions. It's mostly by agreement. But clearly, if somebody wanted to protest that, the protest should not be based upon the court reporter's inability to give the oath.
Any further questions for Mr. Nasser? Not. Thank you again.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Any further comments on proposal number 9? Being done, we'll move to proposal number 10, which would be a proposal to amend SDCL 19-2 by adoption of Federal Rules of Evidence 413 and 414. Any opponents? Any proponents? Representative Cutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. For the record, I'm Joni Cutler here, an attorney here in Sioux Falls and also state representative for District 14. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to appear and explain some of the rationale for bringing this recommendation to incorporate into our rules of evidence, Federal Rules of Evidence 413 and 414. As a housekeeping measure, I'd just note that the reference to the statute should be SDCL 1912 instead of 192. I have practiced law for 11 years here in Minnehaha County and have taught criminal law, criminal procedure, and evidence at the undergraduate level for 10 years. In the past, I've served on the State Bar Family Law Committee and most recently on the Criminal Pattern Jury Instruction Committee. As a legislator, I've had the privilege of chairing the criminal code revision dealing with Title 22, our criminal code, which I hope doesn't have me in too much trouble here today. I have served on the House Judiciary Committee for the past 4 years and have chaired that committee for the past 2 years. And I've just completed my service on the Sexual Assault Task Force, which was authorized by the 2006 legislature to study sexual assault in South Dakota. Though there are several good and important reasons to adopt these evidentiary rules, without taking too much time, I think it's important to focus on a few of them. And while I realize that sexual assault and child molestation are never comfortable topics, even when we're just discussing evidentiary rules, I'll do my best to summarize these issues in a manner I hope is appropriate for these public hearings. In a nutshell, adoption of Federal Rules 413 and 414 will allow what may otherwise be categorized as propensity evidence of prior sexual assault or child molestation into evidence against a defendant charged with sexual assault or child molestation. What justifies this departure from the long-held legal tradition of protecting defendants from this type of evidence? Part of the answer lies in the legislative history of this rule. In 1994, against the majority recommendation of the Standing and Advisory Committees on Evidentiary Rules In fact, the only support coming from the representatives of the Department of Justice, Congress enacted these rules as part of the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act, despite the concerns articulated by the committees about the proposed rule changes and without deference to their position that in the alternative to passing these rules, Congress considers simply amending Federal Rule 404 and 405. The policy considerations that were the driving force behind Congress's enactment of these rules are no less the same today, same concerns today for victims of sexual assault and child molestation. And the enlightenment of society and Congress that justified the rule change then, even more obvious to us today, should lead us to the adoption of these rules for South Dakota courts. In remarks about the rule changes, Representative Susan Molinari, the principal House sponsor, noted the restrictive aspects of 404B, which is our SDCL 1912-5, in sex offense cases. The need for reform of the rules to address the distinctive nature of sexual assault and child molestation cases that set these cases apart from other types of cases, and the need for the practical effect of putting this type of evidence on the same footing as other types of relevant evidence not subject to a special exclusionary rule. The underlying legislative judgment being that this evidence should be admissible as typically relevant and probative, and that its probative value is normally not outweighed by any risk of prejudice or other adverse effects, but that the other general standards of the rules of evidence would continue to apply, including the court's authority under the balancing test of Rule 403, our SDCL 1912-3. Reviewing a few cases from the different circuits, the constitutional challenges that have been made to these revisions have failed, and the fears of the 1994 advisory committees have largely been put to rest. Today, from the most recent totals that I could find from a 2004 Law Review article, all federal courts, all military courts, and 19 other states have adopted some type of this change. I'd also like to share a few additional observations for the court's consideration that I believe are very important to this proposed change. Historically, sexual assault cases turn on the credibility of witnesses, and most of the time these witnesses are female. According to a 2006 Hamline University Law Review article by Tamara Larson, females comprise 93% of assault victims, sexual assault victims, and 77% of child molestation victims. Thus, their testimony has a cultural context that also supports the need for this change. It's not that long ago that the law didn't even recognize the right to be free from sexual assault of an acquaintance. A woman had to be able to show physical resistance, and there still exists today a statistical inverse relationship between how acquainted the victim is to the defendant, and the success of the prosecution of the case. As you know, it's not that long ago that the law failed to even recognize the sexual assault of a married woman. Spousal rape was not recognized under the law, and many of those changes in the law are as recent as the 1980s and 1990s. Furthermore, the fear of false accusation has been given more credibility in society and the courts throughout history than it deserves. The reality is that false accusation occurs less frequently in rape allegations, the national statistics around 1% or less, than many other types of crimes. And the history of the law and treatment of victims in the system reflect an attitude of victim blaming that somehow the victim asked for it, that's not found in the prosecution of other crimes. The reality is that a rapist has only about a 4% chance of being arrested, prosecuted, and found guilty. Because sexual assault is difficult to prosecute, difficult for juries to hear about, and difficult because of the evidentiary standards that work against their testimony, many victims choose not to report, fearing re-victimization in the criminal justice system. Testimony from law enforcement at the Sexual Assault Task Force confirms sexual assault is a very underreported crime in South Dakota. Indeed, attacking the complaining victim's credibility to defeat the case in sexual assault cases is so common that college textbooks now refer to it as the nuts and sluts defense. Despite recent passage of rape shield laws meant to help cope with this problem. In 2003, the Bureau of Justice reported that just 38.5% of rape and sexual assault crimes were reported to the police. And as far back as 1982, one study reported 67% of rapists and 50% of child molesters had committed a sexual offense for which they had not been arrested or convicted. Far from delivering the CSI type of evidence that juries have become sensitized to expect, recent testimony at the Sexual Assault Task Force was that oftentimes, due to the trauma and the treatment victims receive, many times there exists a delay in reporting that compromises the physical forensic evidence available. Additionally, the testimony was that only one hospital in all of South Dakota uses certified nurse examiners in the collection of evidence in rape cases, further risking the compromise of critical physical evidence. The result in sexual assault cases is continued reliance on and competition for credibility with the jurors based on testimonial evidence alone, despite the social stigma and bias that these victims face. Likewise, child molestation is a painful, horrifying crime, and society is coming to grips with the reality that it is more prevalent and brutal than we dared believe in the past. The testimony is harsh. The victims suffer to tell it, and society suffers to hear it. The statistical realities have led lawmakers, both at the federal and state levels, to create categories of crime dealing with child predators and pedophiles. We should have no doubt of the intent evidenced in the changes in the law to keep us free and protect us from these offenders and bring to justice for these victims. These cases have the same testimonial credibility issues and victim stigmas to overcome, along with the difficulty child witnesses face. And these cases also oftentimes lack physical evidence due to the lack of action on the part of parents or authorities who are slow to believe the children who report to them. Finally, then, will adoption of these rules create unfairness to defendants in the system? No. The reality is there already exist exceptions in 404B, and creating more fairness for victims does not necessarily mean unfairness for defendants. Any unfair prejudice is still identified and dealt with by the court in the application of 1912(3), the balancing test for probative value and unfair prejudice. There is also a 15-day notice requirement. This will create more even application by the circuits of what will come into evidence, and it better serves the overall aims of justice. It has been already found by the courts to be both logical and rational in the constitutional challenges that have been made. And juries will be better equipped to make just decisions about the credibility of the witnesses before them in these types of cases. With that, I thank the court for the time and attention to this critical issue and urge your adoption of the rules.
Thank you, Representative Keller. Any questions from the court?
Is this the identical federal rule?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments on proposal number 11? Or 10, excuse me. Number 11, then, the final proposal. Do you have comments? Excuse me.
Thank you. Krista Heron with the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. I also just served on the Sexual Assault Task Force this summer that was appointed by the legislature in 2006. And I, since Representative Cutler did such an eloquent job in explaining the position, I don't want to be repetitive, but we do want to, on the record, offer our support for this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments on proposal number? Another one? Okay.
Good afternoon. I'm Connie Larson. I work for the Attorney General's Office. We are here to offer our office's support. Hope Matchin is also present, and on behalf of the Minnehaha County State's Attorney's Office and the State's Attorneys Association, we would like to voice our support as well.
Thank you. Any other comments on proposal number 10? If not, we'll move to number 11, which would amend 23A43. Any opponents to this proposal? Any proponents for number 11? Okay, there being none, and that having covered all the proposals in front of the court, we'll stand in recess. Thank you for coming.